Well, thanks to all the talk of the fiscal cliff and whether we can manage to avoid it or not, taxes are on our minds a little more than they might be usually at this time of year. But that doesn't necessarily mean that we know just what we need to get done before the end of 2012 and what we can take care of after, but still count it towards this tax year. Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller today. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Dale Kunin is a certified public accountant and a certified information technology professional. She holds an MS in accounting science from UW-Madison and has over 20 years of experience as an accounting professional working in public accounting, private industry, government, and education. She's a partner with Wagner LLP, CPAs, and consultants here in Madison, and she came by a couple of times to help us out before the last tax day, and lucky for us, she's here again. Dale, thanks so much for coming back to the show.
Thanks for asking me.
It doesn't seem like it's possible that it's time to be talking about taxes again, but there it is on the calendar. Just so everyone knows, we try to do about four tax shows before tax day, so about one a month. So if you are not able to ask a question today, or if you think of something afterwards or find out about something afterwards, there will be other opportunities between now and April 15th. Well, Dale, let's start. You know, we were kind of joking before the show that if you wanted to have a really good drinking game, using the term fiscal cliff would probably have everybody having a good time pretty quickly, because it seems like you can't turn around without hearing something about the impending fiscal cliff. But really, what impact might it have? And of course, we don't know if or how it'll be resolved, so we can't say for sure. But what are the possible impacts on our 2012 taxes? Because I think, like me, a lot of people might have thought, well, whatever happens or doesn't will impact us going forward. But in fact, there are things that could impact us for this current year.
Yes, there are. We're in the situation of we don't know. We don't know what's going to happen. Can't remember being so late in the year where we still don't know. One of the main things that would affect the average taxpayer is the AMT, the alternative minimum tax, and the so-called patch, where Congress or the legislation fixes it each year because it's an alternative tax system, and it was never set up to be indexed for inflation.
Okay.
So every year there's some adjustment made, and there hasn't been an adjustment made for 2012. And if there is not an adjustment made, the exemption for a married couple for being hit with the AMT is going to drop from about $74,000 to $45,000 of taxable income.
So who uses the alternative?
Everybody technically has to use it.
Okay.
It was set up to be to tax the wealthy, whose deductions and exemptions otherwise might make them pay little or no taxes. So it's a separate system where you figure out your taxes by the regular system, then you figure them out by the AMT, where certain deductions are not allowed and certain exemptions are not allowed. So you get a different answer.
Okay.
And then that amount is an answer for your taxable income, and that amount is subject to income tax. And the average taxpayer, those in lower income, are typically not affected by it. It wasn't intended to affect them. But without a patch, it will affect taxpayers whose taxable income is above $45,000.
And you said that's for a couple.
A couple.
So that's
Single is like 30, will be 33,000.
So what are we talking about then with that drop, if the patch isn't put in place, the drop from, what did you say, 79 or something?
74.
74 down to 45.
Even if your taxes with their deductions on the regular basis yields you $1,000 of taxes, you might have to pay more taxes because under the alternative minimum tax, it is your taxes would be based without those exemptions that might, or deductions that might otherwise qualify. So there's a separate line on the 1040 that has you determine your alternative minimum income tax, and it's added on to your regular tax, and it means more dollars for the government and more out-of-pocket for the taxpayer.
So, as you said, this wasn't meant to affect lower-income people, but with that drop, or middle-income, but with that drop,
yes,
it's going to affect a lot more people.
It could.
It could.
If
everything will be in the conditional.
If they don't make the patch, which so far they haven't done.
And that's part of this whole big process that they are going through or should be going through.
Right. It didn't used to be attached to such a huge project, as you said, but it's one of the things that Congress has typically done before the end of the mm-hmm. year. Mm-hmm. And they're concentrating on all these other issues. And so far, we haven't seen any change forthcoming for the alternative minimum tax. We have been going on the assumption that they're going to change it. But as each day goes by, we're trying to let people know that might not get changed.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Dale Kunin. She's a CPA and a tax specialist. We're talking about getting ready to file our taxes. April 15th is less than 4 months away. And while that can seem like a long time, it can creep up on you pretty quickly. You're more than welcome to call with your questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also send us an email at talk@wpr.org. Rhonda Fanning, our on-air producer today, will be happy to get your questions to us. Now, Dale, what else is there that might affect our 2012 tax filing that's still up in the air?
Well, it goes back to what hasn't been extended. And for example, the tuition fees and deductions was extended, that deduction that many parents of college students enjoy, was extended through 2011. It's going to expire. It did expire unless they choose to extend that.
And what did that do exactly? What was the deduction?
It was a deduction for tuition that was taken on against gross income, so it would reduce taxable income for qualifying parents who are paying for a dependent to go to school. So that right now, it doesn't exist.
So someone might have been taking a pretty sizable deduction for that.
A couple thousand would be the limit, but yes. And
that might just, well, it has gone away and it might not be put back in place.
Exactly. Another item that was not extended, which probably doesn't affect as many people, but there was the opportunity to contribute from your IRA directly to a charity. And that would not be counted in your income. So otherwise, people who have IRAs, which are retirement accounts, when they take money out, it's taxable. Mm-hmm. So it wouldn't if you take money out and you have to record that as your gross income mm-hmm. for the year, then you would take a charitable contribution deduction. But meanwhile, your adjusted gross income has gone up, and there's different items that kick in if your adjusted gross income is above a
certain amount.
Right,
it might have put you into a higher category.
And maybe made it so that your exemptions would be limited. So there was, through 2011, the option to contribute directly from the IRA to a charity directly, and then
so basically not passing through your your bottom line.
So you did exactly your top line or your bottom line, and that has gone away, and so it hasn't been extended. And if it does get extended, there's 2 days left to make that. So it looks like that's gone as well. If this sales tax deduction option in itemized deductions also expired, so unless they put that back in, which they might, it doesn't affect Wisconsin taxpayers as much because we are we pay state income taxes, and most taxpayers' state income tax is higher than their the sales tax that they pay. So it affects more the states where they don't have income tax, and that option is off the table unless they put it back in. Another item that's gone is there was a deduction above the line for teachers to take a $250 deduction for their out-of-pocket costs.
Which, from what I hear, pretty much every teacher spends that and probably a lot more.
They do. And that's expired and hasn't been put back in as well.
Wow. So a lot of things, a lot of things up in the air, but if it's not just up in the air, if there isn't direct action to put them back in place, they're just gone.
Right.
Well, and it is, I know, Dale, it is very hard for you to advise people, whether here on the show or in your private practice, because there are a lot more unknowns than knowns at this point.
It seems that way.
Makes it a little more stressful during a stressful time.
Yes. Well, I wish I had more answers.
Well, we'll do our best. And we are talking with Dale Kunin, CPA with Wagner and Associates here in Madison. And Kim in Mequon is on the phone, so let's go there. Hi, Kim.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
I just had a question. We have a home in Mequon, and then we currently have a home up in Mercer, and we just bought another house in Mercer. And regarding the taxes, can I claim all three homes or file all three? We paid all three this year as well. Can I file all three of those on Wisconsin and federal taxes?
Are you talking about the real estate taxes that you paid?
Yeah, correct.
Those are all eligible for an itemized deduction.
Okay.
So the answer is yes.
For both the state and federal?
Well, the state actually has a credit, and it's only on your primary residence. So the state doesn't allow a deduction for real estate taxes. They have an actual credit against taxes paid, and that is for taxes paid on your primary residence. And the maximum credit is $300. So you probably are going to get that with your primary residence anyway. But on the federal itemized deductions, yes, you can take all three.
Okay. That was my question.
Great. Thanks, Kim.
Thank you.
And actually, talking about property taxes, there was a question on Facebook from Nola. She says, with the pending fiscal cliff, there it is again, do we want to pay our property taxes before 2013 or split it up and pay it all in 2013?
That's a very good question.
And that was actually a question I was going to ask as well.
So the conventional wisdom was always to accelerate expenses, take the deductions, all that you can find in the current year, and defer revenues if you could. So we always would address the question about the real estate taxes that you should pay them now unless you were in the alternative minimum tax. If you're in the alternative minimum tax, you're not going to get the advantage of the exemption, so it doesn't matter if you pay them now or pay them next year. Well, as I just said, you may very well be in the alternative minimum tax if they don't make a change. So it's anybody's guess what the best way to go. And because we anticipate that tax rates are going to go up next year, pending all this fiscal cliff business, the deduction itself may be more valuable next year if you're in a higher tax bracket and you can deduct it against your income next year. It may be more valuable. So basically, I don't have a good answer other than to say go with what your cash flow tells you to do, because it's kind of a win-win or lose-lose situation. If you're in the AMT, it makes absolutely no difference because you don't get that deduction. If tax rates are going to go up next year, it'll be more valuable next year. If you're not in the AMT and tax rates don't go up, then make them this year. So
I have to say, with all of the uncertainty, though, it seems like it would be pretty surprising if tax rates did not go up next year, because whether we go over the cliff or because most tax rates will go up if nothing is done, right?
If nothing is done, the Bush era tax rates expire,
right,
and marginal tax rates go up. That's true.
And since we're, 3 days out from the end of the year, Congress doesn't move quickly usually.
I don't know.
So
we just heard that President cut his vacation short. So who knows? I wish I knew. And it is not out of the question that they might pass something that's retroactive, mm-hmm, or if they pass it in January for 2013, then it'll apply to 2013.
So really, there's, just to go back to Nola's question, there's no
perfect answer.
So maybe what works best for you and your household, liquidity is the way to go right now.
I anticipate that tax rates will go up for certain taxpayers. That's part of the whole discussion. Is it going to hit middle income? Mm-hmm. Is it only going to be the higher earners? So I don't know whether I should pay my taxes now or I probably will wait.
All right. That's about as good as we can get with all the uncertainty. Dale Kunin is a CPA and tax specialist. She is here helping us try to figure out what to do for tax preparations. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about tax preparation? Do you file your taxes yourself or have someone do them for you? Or are you wondering if maybe you should have someone do them for you? Dale can help you figure that out too, right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Just to let you know, tomorrow at 11, it's another edition of Garden Talk, and we'll be talking about veggies with John Hendrickson. He'll share information about the Wisconsin School for Beginning Market Growers and just some great general information about growing the best veggies. It's hard to imagine digging in the dirt right now with a frozen tundra that's outside most of our windows, but never hurts to get started thinking about next season. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller today, and we are talking about tax preparation with CPA Dale Kunin. And let's go back to the phones and Richard in Milwaukee. Hi, Richard.
How are you doing?
Good.
My question is, this year for the first time I worked the election returns, and I've been told that the first $600 earned working the election returns is tax exempt. Have you ever heard of this?
I think what you are referring to is, I mean, you worked for the Board of Elections, or
correct,
and you got paid as a miscellaneous compensation. So the rules are that a 1099 has to be issued by the payer for any payments for services that are $600 or more. And that's where the $600 rule comes in. However, you as a taxpayer are responsible for reporting all of the income that you make, whether or not you get a 1099 for it.
So even if Richard made, say, $599, he would not get a 1099 necessarily, but he would still be responsible for reporting that entire $599 as income.
That's the correct answer. There are some payers, vendors, whatever, who issue 1099s no matter what the dollar amount is. Some people do it on purpose to require the people that they've paid to report income.
Because that also, the copy, a copy goes to the IRS, to the IRS as well.
But the law is that you have to issue one if it is 600 or more.
Okay.
They told me that they would be issuing no W-2s or any forms for that amount that was earned.
Well, because it was under $600. So they told you they wouldn't be issuing a 1099, and then it's upon you to decide whether you're going to report your income or not.
Okay, but lawfully it is a reportable income.
Yes, it is.
Okay.
All right. Thanks for that, Richard. And let's go next to Terry in Green Bay. Hi, Terry.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Quick question. You were talking about the AMT patch. Is your guest aware of any time after the end of the year, in other words, going to the new year, where Congress has actually put a patch together for AMT or other adjustments and made it retroactive back to the January 1st, because most people aren't preparing their taxes until later in January? And I'll take the answer off the air.
Okay. Thanks for that, Terry.
I can't say with certainty that the AMT patch in the past has actually been voted on in January, but it may be. I don't recall. But it is possible. It is likely that if they're going to patch the AMT, they probably will do it in January and make it retroactive to 2012, because I don't think there's time. I don't know if there is, but I just couldn't tell you with certainty that specifically the AMT patch has been in the past enacted in January and retroactive. But there's been other legislation that they have done that with.
Well, and I guess what I would say too is, while in some situations it might be indicative whether they've done it or not, this is pretty much a never before seen confluence of events, right, with mm-hmm. the fiscal cliff and all that goes along with it. So,
and one of the things that it is of concern is that if they do that, or if they are intending to do that, you have to understand that the IRS has to get their forms and instructions and computers set up for the change that they're going to make,
right,
or not going to make. And so the more they delay it, the more that Congress either says we're not patching it or we are patching it or whatever, the IRS can't not instantly respond. So it may delay the time of when returns can be filed.
So that's right. I guess that makes sense and is obvious, but I hadn't really put it together that the IRS is waiting to find out, too, so that they know
yes.
what the tables are and what the calculations are and mm-hmm. So they basically can't do a whole lot right now to be ready for people to file.
Right. The tables, the tax rates for 2012 are established,
okay.
but the AMT and all those items are programmed in one way or the other, and they'll have to be unprogrammed or reprogrammed. And we were saying that it may be a while before you could file taxes, and we were joking in the office, well, then they should extend the tax filing day, but they probably won't. So
and here I was ready to just jump right on it, and there goes my incentive since we can't anyway. Well, let's go to Tom in Beloit next, or South Beloit, sorry. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. You've kind of just discussed what my question was. last year, Congress screwed up and where they were supposed to do so the IRS could program their stuff, because we all try to file as early as we can. And the tax, even though we gave it to the tax preparer, he said that, because something wasn't in place, it wouldn't go through until, the IRS got their act in order. And so, needless to say, we didn't get our return until, I don't know, March or even mid-March because of the delay that Congress caused. And then you pretty much said that's the same thing that's going to happen this year, right?
We can anticipate that there will be some delays one way or the other.
Okay, well, I'll still follow my same procedure, and as soon as I get all the documents we need, I'll pass them along to the tax preparer and just hope that it comes as soon as it'll come.
Exactly.
Well, thanks for that, Tom. And I guess also, so what about things like TurboTax and the other softwares that people use to file themselves? They must be waiting to get that final information, too.
Yes.
Everybody's on pins and needles.
Yes. There's just no other answer to that. And it all falls on, I mean, we can get all of our stuff in, but until the IRS is ready to accept the returns, and they can't tell us now because they don't know.
Right. Well, Tom brought up a good point, though, that there are, you know, obviously we can still be gathering our documents and stuff. Let's talk about things that need to be or should be done before the end of the calendar year, which again is Monday, to count for 2012 taxes. There's still a weekend to get things done. What about charitable donations?
Charitable donations to be deducted in 2012 need to be made and constructively received by the donee by December 31st. So far for 2012, there's no change in those rules other than what I discussed earlier about the IRAs. And some people think if they write a check and it's dated December 31st, but they don't mail it or give it to the charitable organization, that they can deduct it this year. So they need to complete the donation if they wanted to deduct it. However, I wouldn't be as concerned this year as I have been in previous years, because again, if the tax rates go up, your charitable contribution might be more valuable next year. Of course, they may make changes to the rules that limit those. So,
although my understanding when they were talking about possibly limiting charitable deductions, it was still going to be a pretty high threshold that most people would probably still be well under.
Probably.
Again, lots of uncertainty.
Just have this image of what's going on in Congress, you know, and what they're doing and talking about, and, you know, tell them that their tax returns are going to be held up as well. Maybe that would help. But.
Right. Well, and we were talking earlier about the fact that 1099s are issued, must be issued if it's $600 or more in income. What about charitable donations? What are the requirements for charities to provide documentation? Is there a certain amount? And how do we need to document our charitable giving?
That has not changed. The charitable contributions that are total of more than $250 or $250 or more to one organization, the organization needs to provide a substantiation letter. Other than that, you need to have the IRS does require you to have a receipt or canceled check for other donations. And for non-cash donations, that documentation has been, the required documentation has been up. People used to just pick a number and put it on their return.
Right.
And they still ask me about it because if it's more than $500, there's an extra form that has to be filled out, but the substantiation requirements don't change if it's less than $500. So if you give a non-cash donation, you need to document the date of the donation. You need to document who, you know, what organization you gave it to. A receipt from them is preferable. Most organizations like Goodwill or St. Vincent's, they will not assign a value to that. So you need to document the value, describe the item, keep a list. Some people take pictures depending on, you know, how extensive their contributions are. And if you make multiple contributions of, you know, different items during the year, you need to have those listed. And the more detail, the better. It has to be in good repair. It has to be in good condition. You can't donate ratty underwear. People have that specifically has been ruled not acceptable. And so as detailed of a list as you can maintain and or take pictures mm-hmm. of the items.
I want to go back to the cash donations mm-hmm. or, you know, the financial donations. Yes. So you said for $250 or more, is that a single gift of $250 or say,
combined.
Okay, so if I was giving, say, $25 a month through electronic funds transfer to, oh, let's say Wisconsin Public Radio, I would need a letter.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And what if someone does something like that and the organization that they give to does not provide that documentation?
Well, then the organization has failed its responsibilities. And so I don't really know of an organization that
it's pretty standard practice.
Yes, because it's required by them to get donations
right.
that they need to do that. So it may be a smaller organization, you would have to take it up with them. Mm-hmm. But
okay.
And of course,
but it's total for the year.
It's total okay. in 1 year.
Okay. Well, let's go back to the phones and Ryan in Verona next. Hi, Ryan.
Hi, good morning. I just had a quick question. If the expert could give some examples of common deductions that would be available for single people that are renters, not homeowners, and don't have children. And I'd take any response off here.
Okay, great. Thanks, Ryan. So basically, probably maybe a young single person, not married, no kids, not a homeowner. What kind of deductions are possible for them?
A wage earner, somebody who gets a W-2, doesn't have a lot of options for deductions. And the kind of things that are eligible for itemized deductions, as you say, don't apply. Now, one the biggest one is mortgage interest and real estate taxes, and of course, you wouldn't have that. So, for someone in that situation, charitable contributions and the state income tax are probably your most reasonable ones that you're going to get. But unfortunately or fortunately, most people in that situation are taking the standard deduction in lieu of itemized deduction. So the deductions for tax return preparation and job related expenses or unreimbursed employer expenses, investment fees and that kind of thing are subject to 2%. It has to be more than 2% of your adjusted gross income. So it's difficult for those smaller amounts to mm-hmm. add up to enough to kick in the itemized deductions. So there isn't a whole lot of options for that's what the
single unencumbered person.
Right. The standard deduction is for.
What about student loans? Is there anything with student loan interest or anything that's a deduction?
There can be student loan interest, which is above the line or not an okay. itemized deduction, but there's a maximum of it. And it depends on it's phased out depending on your income.
Mm, okay.
So
it kind of depends on the ratio of mm-hmm. your student loans to your income.
Right. Okay. So it's not going to make a huge difference.
Okay. Well, let's go now to Joe in Franklin. Hi, Joe.
Good morning. Long-term care insurance. Is that deductible? Is it deductible as a medical expense? Does it have to exceed the percentage of AGI?
Yes. It is deductible for the federal as an itemized deduction as part of the medical expenses, which 7.5% of adjusted gross income, but going up, I think, to 10%.
And long-term care insurance covers what? Is it like nursing home care and things like
yes,
that?
Yes. Okay. Yes. So it's considered a medical expense. Wisconsin has a deduction for that separately. It's not 100%. There's a maximum, and it's age-related as well. But it's counted as one of those medical deductions for which there's hard to get over.
You have
that.
To get to a certain mm-hmm. threshold right before it even starts
counting.
Exactly. Okay. All right. Well, let's go now to Chris in Kenosha. Hi, Chris.
Hello. I've been a family member caregiver since the end of 2011, and I'm enabling her to stay in her home. And I'm wondering the best way to report my non-employee caregiver earnings. As other income, or is there some other way I should be doing it?
Okay, so you're getting paid to take care of this family member, or you?
Yes.
Yes. So,
and does it matter paid by whom, or
are you getting paid directly by the person, or is there a program that you're getting?
No program.
So, you really are an employee, a household employee. That makes the person that you're taking care of a household employer, and so the technically correct way to do that is for that person, your loved one, to become an employer and pay a payroll, and then you would get a W-2. If that hasn't happened, then I don't know the amounts, but you may want to consider it a gift from that she's been providing, or he, a gift, and if it's under $13,000, then there wouldn't have to be there wouldn't be any income reported,
there wouldn't be tax implications,
right? But if you have been getting paid regularly, technically you should be an employee. But the other option is for the person to issue a 1099 as a miscellaneous, as you said, a non-employee compensation, although it really is an employee, and that way. You would then be responsible for paying self-employment taxes. It isn't too late for that to be considered wages and a W-2, because the federal taxes can be, for a household employee, can be reported and paid on your individual income tax return at the time that you filed, or that the loved one files mm-hmm. that tax return. So,
If she does the 1099 miscellaneous, when does that have to be filed for the government?
It has to be in the hands of the recipient by January 31st, and it has to be to the government if it's not filed electronically by the end of February.
Okay.
So just to clarify there, so if it's a 1099, the loved one that's being taken care of pays no taxes, but Chris would pay taxes mm-hmm. on that.
Yes.
If it's a W-2, then is the loved one responsible for paying part of the payroll tax and then Chris is paying the rest?
Yes, and the person being taken care of can report those taxes on their individual, their 1040, when they file it. So they have a separate rule for household employees that they can do that.
Does that take care of it, Chris?
In a way, I did talk to the family member's care tax man, and he said that I was not an employee. So that's why I was kind of uncertain as to what direction I should go there. Thank you for the information. I guess I'll leave it at that for now.
Okay.
All right. Thanks so much, Chris. And we are talking with Dale Kunin. She's a CPA and a tax specialist with Wegner & Associates.
Wagner CPAs.
Wagner CPAs. Sorry, I knew I wasn't getting it quite right. She's a partner with Wagner LLP CPAs and Consultants in Madison. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234, or you can send us an email at talk@wpr.org. There's a lot of uncertainty going on because of the fiscal cliff negotiations and what may or may not get taken care of, or taken care of retroactively, or not taken care of at all. But Dale Kunin is doing her best to share what is for sure and what how we can hedge our bets a little bit and try to minimize whatever impact all these negotiations and decisions at the federal level might have on us. And Dale, before we go back to the phones, let's talk a little bit more about things that we really should do before the end of the calendar year. We talked about charitable donations. I have to say, one year I was trying to make some charitable donations before the end of the year. And so I think it was on the 31st, probably. I was online making all kinds of gifts. And I must have done a little too many in too short a time, because the credit card company actually called me to ask if somebody had stolen my credit card because I was making so many purchases online. I said, no, actually, they're charitable gifts, but thanks for checking. So, but that's definitely one thing we want to get done before the end of the year. What about any contributions to investments?
What do you mean by contributions?
Well, should we be making contributions to, say, IRAs or things like that?
So retirement accounts, it's always good to make contributions to retirement accounts, because whether they're deferred for income tax or not, to save for the time when you get closer to my age, the younger you do that, the happier you'll be. The retirement contributions have some flexibility in that the IRA contribution, if that's what you're doing, doesn't have to be made for 2012 until April 15th of 2013. So that gives you some time if cash flow isn't, and you still can deduct it if it's a deductible contribution. The same with self-employed people who have what we call a SEP. They have until the extended due date of the return to make that contribution. So they actually could wait until October to make the contribution that's deducted from their taxes in 2012. If you participate in a 401k plan at work, though, you do not have that flexibility.
Okay, so 401k is by December 31st. Okay. IRAs is April 15th. And a SEP, you can actually wait all the way till October.
If you file
the extension.
Yep.
And I think, needless to say, but just to make sure people know, so if you write a check April 1st for your IRA and you're counting it for 2012, obviously it only counts for 2012, even though you're
double dipping. You need to tell the custodian of the account that it's a 2012 contribution versus a 2013. Of course, the sooner you make the investment, the sooner it starts working for you. So
the more interest.
Yes.
Well, actually, we have some callers who have questions about IRAs. So let's go back to the phones and Mary in Menominee Falls. Hi, Mary.
Hello, ladies.
Hi.
I have a very simple question about an IRA. We have a CD IRA, and we moved from to different city. And I want to know if we can, and we transferred all our other banking to a bank where we are now. But I don't know if the IRA, can we just transfer that? I know you're not allowed to take money out of it without a fine or a penalty.
You can make a trustee-to-trustee transfer where you can have, if it's in a bank and you want it in a different bank or mutual fund, that they transfer the money directly and it doesn't get counted as a withdrawal for you.
But, okay. Mary, is there a reason why you really need to move that CD if it's just going to be sitting there?
Well, because it's in a bank. It's 50 miles away from where we live. And I just as soon have everything here so that we can get to it. We're octogenarians, and we can't be flying all over the place.
Okay.
So you can go to the bank that you want to put it in, and they can arrange the electronic transfer directly from the other bank.
And Dale, does it matter for Mary if she when she does that for tax purposes? It's because it's not there's no tax implication.
Right.
Great. All right, Mary. We hope you can get all your ducks in a row in one town. And Dave in Deerfield also has an IRA question, so let's go there. Hi, Dave.
Hi, good morning. My question is, I think I know the answer, but I want to, if you want to transfer, take money out of a traditional IRA and put it into a Roth, but you don't think you're going to get it done before the end of this year, can you do that in, up until April 15th? Or that money that I take out of the traditional, that'll be income for 2013 and not 2012? You kind of understand what I'm saying?
Yes, you can make the change now, and then you can do what's called a recharacterization if you change your mind, as long as you do it before April 15th. So
what I meant is if I did not get it done now, if I, for whatever reason, I don't think I got my ducks in a row yet, and I try to do it in the first couple months or 3 months of 2013, I can't retroactively say that
no, then it will be a withdrawal for 2013. It will go against your income.
I didn't confuse a lot of people, but I think you understand what I'm saying, and I understand what you're saying, too.
So okay. It goes with when the money is withdrawn. That's the year that you get taxed on it.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Dave. And actually, Dale, let's take a moment and talk about the difference between Roth and traditional IRAs. But I want to let people know we do have a couple lines open finally. So if you'd like to join in, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in with Dale Kunin, CPA and tax specialist. What is the difference between a Roth IRA and a traditional IRA?
A traditional IRA is a deduction from the year that you make the contribution or that it's assigned to. It's a deduction from your taxable income for that year. And then the investment grows tax-free until when you reach age 70 and a half, you have to start taking it out. And any withdrawal from a traditional IRA is subject to income taxes to whatever the rate is at the time that you're taking it out. A Roth IRA was a gift from Congress where you don't get to deduct the contribution in the year that you make it, but it grows tax-free. All the earnings on it, all the growth, if it's stock and it doubles mm-hmm. or triples or whatever, is never subject to taxation. So you can take that out. You or your heirs can take it out without having to pay any income tax on it. And it has no minimum distribution requirement. So you don't have to start depleting that tax-free account when you're 70 and a half. You can, if you don't need it at the time, it can continue to grow tax-free, and it can be left to your heirs as also tax-free. Mm-hmm.
My understanding was that Roth IRAs are especially good for young people who are just kind of getting started in their careers and probably, although nothing is sure, probably making less at that point in their lives than they would be perhaps later. And like you said, a lot of people at that point in their lives are not taking deductions anyway and things like that. So putting money into a Roth, you're not getting the tax write-off of that amount, but later on when you would be maybe at a higher tax level, you're getting that money out tax-free.
That's true. I believe that the Roth IRAs are good at any age because you can invest in it and it then can hopefully grow and none of that will be taxed. However, there have been restrictions on the income level of when you can make an IRA, a Roth contribution. And a lot of the discussion about it's better for young people revolves around whether you should convert an existing IRA, pay the taxes into a Roth IRA,
okay,
which is different from making the contributions, because if a young person makes a Roth or a traditional IRA early in their life and they continue to make that, it's going to grow into an awesome amount, mm-hmm, by the time they're ready to use it. Mm-hmm. So, and with the Roth IRAs, it's going to grow forever, tax-free, and we know that tax rates are going up, so it's going to be there, available. So I think Roths are awesome, and I'm surprised that Congress hasn't realized that.
We are talking about tax preparation with CPA Dale Kunin. She's a partner with Wegner CPAs in Madison. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Dale will be with us up until 12:30, so stay tuned. If the thought that tax day is less than 4 months away raises your blood pressure, I can pretty much guarantee that you're not alone. Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Thanks for spending time with us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Chances are you have some questions about how to file your taxes correctly, and especially what to do before December 31st. We're happy to have CPA and tax specialist Dale Kunin with us for the next half hour. Dale has lots of great advice and tips, and she's happy to answer your questions, too. Wonder how life changes like a new job, getting married, or buying a home might change your taxes for better or for worse? Want to decrease your taxable income? Or maybe you wonder what credits or rebates are available. You can join in by calling us at 1-800-642-1234. And you can go to our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mueller Show. If you like it, you'll get daily updates on show topics and more. We'll be back right after the news with Dale. Please stay tuned. Benjamin Franklin said that, "In this world, nothing can be said to be certain except death and taxes." But one big difference between the two is that tax day comes around every year. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller today. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. There are things we need to get done before the end of 2012 for it to count for this current tax year, and some of them can make a big difference in how much we end up owing. Dale Kunin is a certified public accountant and a certified information technology professional. She holds an MS in accounting science from UW-Madison and has over 20 years of experience as an accounting professional working in public accounting, private industry, government, and education. And she is a partner with Wegner CPAs in Madison. Dale, thanks again for coming back and talking with us today.
It's my pleasure.
Well, we have some folks on the phone who've been waiting quite a while, so I want to make sure we get to them. Let's go to Gary and Edgar first. Hi, Gary.
Hello. Great show. I have a two-part question. One is, my brothers and sisters and I recently sold my parents' home, which they had passed away, and the abstract company gave us a substitute form 1099-S, and I was wondering how I do that for filing in my taxes.
So to whom was the form made out? You said that it was your siblings.
Okay, the home had been left to the five siblings about 8 years ago, mm-hmm, in one of those setups, you know. And,
mm-hmm,
and so then after my parents passed, we finally have decided to sell it, and we sold it. And so it was made out to the five siblings.
So the actual form has all five of your names on it?
No, each one of us got a form with our share.
Perfect. Perfect. So,
okay.
So what you have to do is report that as a sale of a capital sale on Schedule D, and the difference between what the value was at the date of death and what you sold it for is your gain or your loss.
Okay, because it dropped. My dad had passed away in 05, and of course, you know what the housing market did, so we sold it for considerably less than what it was at the time when they passed.
And what did you do with the property in the time between you lost your parents and you sold it?
We allowed one of our one of the grandchildren to stay there, and all they had to do was pay the taxes and utilities. And so we weren't using it as income. We were just, you know, putting it sort of on hold until we decided what to do.
So then it was treated as investment property, and you didn't report any income each year for the rent that he didn't pay?
No.
So it will be the difference between your share of what the value was at the date of death and the sale will be a capital loss for you.
Okay, so if, say, the value dropped $30,000,
mm-hmm.
then I would take one-fifth of that off of, because there were five of us, off of what I got it for?
No, you have to go back to, on the form, you have to put the original value or the date of death value, your share of the date of death value, and you have to report the amount that was reported on that form. And the difference between that is the result. You don't put the result down. You have to put the value and the sale price.
And so the sale price, which will be less than what the value was when it was gifted, how will he report that? Is that just another line on the return, or is there a separate form?
It's on Schedule D, and there's a place for the date of acquisition, which will be the date of the death, and the amount at acquisition will be the date of death value. And then there's another row that's the date of sale and the amount of sale. And then there's a place to put the difference.
Okay. They had put it in whatever type of trust so that we owned the house while they still lived there for the rest of their lives. They had done that far back in time.
Mm-hmm.
So I would have to find out what the value was considered at that point in time. And that I could find out from the local municipality would have the tax records.
Well, there must have been something in when they in their state when they died, either probate or the trust, so that they had to inventory the what assets they had. So you should be able to get it from whoever handled that part of.
Because it sounds like there is a form that has a stated value mm-hmm. on it. So that's what. That's what Gary should be going with.
Yeah.
All right, good luck with that, Gary. And let's go next to Jack and DePere. Hi, Jack.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question regarding gifting. I have a cabin up north in some acreage, valued probably at about $60,000.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like to take about half of that and give that to my three kids. Is there any tax implications? Is there a maximum amount I can give in a year? Is there advantage to doing it before the end of the year? And with it being property, how do you do it?
So you can gift to are you single or married?
Married.
So you own that together. So each person, taxpayer can gift another taxpayer $13,000 a year in 2012, and I believe it's going up to 14 in 2013. I have to verify that. So that means that between your wife and yourself, you can gift each child this year $26,000 without. Which is the gift exclusion without any tax consequences. So it sounds like the value of that cabin is under the gifting exclusions. So you can take care of the deeds and without any tax consequences.
On either side.
I would do it through like a deed, through like a quitclaim deed or...
I'm not exactly sure how you transfer the property. That would probably be a legal question.
Yeah, I was going to say maybe a lawyer. But just to follow up on Jack's question there, so the $13,000 threshold for whether there's a tax implication or not, that's either cash $13,000 or $13,000 value in something.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And just to clarify, that's a threshold for tax for no tax implication for either the giver or...
Yes, and actually
recipient.
Any gift taxes is on the giver's side, not the recipient side.
Oh, interesting. Okay, great. Well, thanks for that call, Jack. And let's go next to Scott in Mequon. Hi, Scott.
Hello. I'm wondering, I have a farm as part of an LLC, and I'm wondering, I get about $6,000 in rent a year. Do I have to issue a 1099 to the farmer who's renting the land?
No, the farmer who rents the land is the one that has to issue. It's the person to whom the payments are made, because the idea is then that you would report that income.
Oh, okay.
So the person that's renting it should be giving Scott a 1099.
Mm-hmm. Sounds good.
All right. Thanks, Scott. And moving right along here, let's go to Kirsten in Oshkosh. Hi, Kirsten.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have three. I think there are quick answers to these questions. Maybe not. They could be complicated.
I don't know. But, we're talking about taxes, so.
Yeah, right. This is complicated. I'm in a domestic partnership, and we both own a house together, one house. And I'm wondering how we go about claiming the property tax that we've paid, and then also the insurance and really everything. Is there a kind of a set standard as far as how that works, you know, as two individuals
sure.
owning that property? And then the second part of my question, this may be more complicated, but we also have a child together, but I'm the non-biological parent, but I'm still supporting that child, certainly at, you know, a significant degree. So I'm wondering if that at all applies. And then the third piece, okay, that's it. This is the last part, is... are there any things that we should be taking advantage of, given that there are so few advantages for people in our situation?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I'll try to answer these questions. The first one about how you split the deductions. You own the home jointly. You each are tenants in common, or you each
joint
own.
Tenancy.
So, and you each contribute equally.
Well, not exactly, because our incomes are different. But
when you purchase the home, you...
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So technically, if you're tenants in common, then you each own 50% or half.
Right.
And so you would be entitled to half of the deductions if you, in fact, half of it if you made them. So it's really a... gray area, because technically if one person pays all of the mortgage interest and the other person paid nothing, then the first person really is only entitled to half. I mean, that's the according to the rules, but practically you can't take a deduction for something that you don't own. So if you don't own 100%, you can't take 100%. And, you know, if I paid Judith's taxes,
okay.
I'm not obligated for it. So I couldn't take that as a deduction.
So basically, sure. Even if one person pays the whole amount, the most that they're able to claim is 50%.
Technically.
So, okay.
Technically, yes. So the simplest way is to split it evenly. When I'm preparing domestic partner tax returns, we look at what provides the most tax benefit.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as the child, if you are providing more than 50% of that child support, you can take the child as a dependent. Only one person can take the child as a dependent. So it can be you or it can be your partner, but only one. For purposes of the earned income credit, which I don't know if you're eligible for, the treatment of the child or the definition of who a child is, it has to be your legally adopted child or your biological child. But that is the strict definition for a child or dependent child for the earned income credit, but not for dependency for getting an exemption.
Okay.
And I forgot what the last part was,
whether there are any other things that they should be trying to take advantage of, given that there aren't as many advantages to a domestic partnership as to a marriage.
as you know, you have to file two separate tax returns. And as the tax law exists now, there the if you both made the same amount of money, if one of you can file as head of household, whoever takes the dependent can. So you may want to look at who would get the best advantage to taking the head of household status, which is a more tax favorable status than single.
Okay, that's good to know. We didn't know that we could, one of us could take that. So that's
yes.
Very helpful.
Good.
I'm glad.
Thanks for calling, Kirsten. And let's now move on to Barbara in Shawano.
Okay.
Hi, Barbara.
Yes, thank you very much for, you know, helping me out with this answer, because it's really, it's got me concerned.
Sure.
Well, presently, I am on disability because I am hurt in certain parts of my body. And also, I do collect Social Security. And my son has put in for me a savings account, and he had more or less indicated that he's 52 years old, quite a bit younger than I am right now. And he more or less said in the event that he should ever expire, that he would want me to take care of the funeral and expenses and so forth. And with me being on disability and the Social Security, I understand that I could take out for his funeral and that, but this is quite a sum of money that we're dealing with that he has put out for me. So how would that work?
I'm sorry, but I'm not sure we're clear on what the question is. So your question is about...
Would I be eligible for that money because I'm on a disability program? And you know what I mean? That's a pretty strict program. You know that.
So basically, would what you inherit from your son be considered income that could affect your disability status?
Something like that.
Okay.
Is it Social Security disability or...
I'm on two parts, Social Security and also disability. I received two of them.
Disability from Social Security.
Exactly.
I do not believe that an inheritance would affect that because inheritance is not considered income. However, for Medicaid and then it is considered an asset. So, if you are on Medicaid or need Medicaid, it would not – it would count against you.
I'm guessing, Dale, that maybe it would be good for Barbara to talk to someone in the Disability Administration to ask, because I'm sure it's not the first time that they've had that issue. All right. Thanks for that, Barbara. And let's go to Marge in Janesville. Hi, Marge.
Yes, thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
I have a question concerning – I presently have – a traditional IRA. I'm 74 years old, and I'm curious about at my age, should I be considering transferring or switching over to a Roth IRA? I only have an income from Social Security, and I have a pension and IRA. That's my total funds.
Well, there's several things to consider. And one of the first ones is, do you have assets to pay the income tax on what you would have to pay if you took the money out and converted it to the Roth outside of the IRA itself?
Well, I wouldn't have any idea how much it would cost me to switch to a Roth IRA. I have probably $70,000 in cash. I own my own home.
$70,000 that's not in the IRA?
Correct.
So this is something you probably should talk with a financial advisor about, because the reason to do that would be you would be paying the taxes now and then hoping that the taxes, because you know that the taxes would go up in the future. But the main reason I would see for you to do that at this point is if you wanted to leave it for your heirs, if you don't need it in retirement, that would be the only reason to consider doing it. And then you'd have to crunch the numbers to see.
don't have heirs. I expected to leave everything to various, to a couple of close people and the rest into charitable organizations, including the radio station.
Oh, well,
all
thank
right.
you.
Well, then I really don't think that it would be, just from those limited information, that it would be of benefit for you to convert it at this point.
Because especially for the charities, they would not have to pay tax anyway,
correct.
Right? Correct. So it sounds like maybe for Marge in her mm-hmm. situation, it's not the best. But let's go to Gary in De Pere because I think he has a similar question. Hi, Gary.
Hi. My question is the same kind of question. I'm wondering whether or not a required minimum distribution from the regular IRA can be converted to the Roth IRA.
You can't make a contribution to a Roth unless you have earned income. So if you have earned income, you can contribute whatever cash you have to a Roth IRA. But to convert your traditional IRA to a Roth, you can't convert the distribution because it's already taken out. The conversion to the Roth is the funds that are in the Roth, in the traditional get converted to the Roth with all the taxes attached. The required minimum distribution you have to take out, and if you have earned, and it just becomes your cash available, mm-hmm. if you have earned income, you can make a Roth contribution, but if you don't have earned income, you can't make a Roth contribution.
So if my required minimum distribution is
$5,000,
I can't convert any of the $5,000 to the Roth IRA.
No.
But I could take out an additional $2,000 or $3,000 in addition to the $5,000 and convert that $2,000 or $3,000 to the Roth IRA.
You can't convert what you withdraw. You can only convert what's still in the traditional IRA. So the other option is to make a contribution.
Mm-hmm. So Gary could withdraw and then take that as income, but then turn around and invest it in a new Roth.
If he has earned income, he can't invest
okay.
it in a Roth unless he has earned income.
All right. Well, thanks for that call, Gary. And we have just about a minute left, Dale, and I just want to quickly go over what are the things that you as a tax preparer advise people to make sure they get done by December 31st?
Well, traditionally, it's make your state estimated payment. If you're not in the AMT, make it before the end of the year. Pay your real estate taxes by the end of the year if you're not in AMT. Make all your charitable contributions that you plan to do. If you own your own business as an S-Corp and you want to take a bonus, you have to get that into the bank before the end of the year. But as I said at the beginning, those may not apply.
All bets are off right now. Right. And so we just listen and see what happens with the fiscal cliff. Dale Kunin is a CPA with Wegner CPAs here in Madison, and she has been with us sharing tax preparation advice. Dale, thanks so much for spending time with us.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
And we will be back tomorrow with Garden Talk, and we'll be talking with John Hendrickson. He is with the School for Beginning Market Growers, and he'll have great advice on growing beautiful veggies next season. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Stay tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.